Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Hartung, who's Project Director at the Center for International Policy. He was previously a Senior Research Fellow at the New American Foundation's American Strategy Program and Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And we were just speaking with Russell Rumbaugh, who's had very extensive experience inside the defense and intelligence world in terms of budgeting. He says that since the military budget has doubled since 9/11 for several years now, a decade, that there's been quite a lot of procurement that's going on. It hasn't all been spent on wars. And so what does that mean to your mind then, as Panetta faces this choice of having to take $450 billion out of the defense budget in the next decade? Otherwise, he'll be hit with the blunt instrument that would come out of the super committee if they fail to come to an agreement.
Well, you know, I think Panetta's trying to be, win the turf war, and he's going to keep as much money for his department as possible. But actually, you know, the down payment, the $450 billion, is barely, it's a little less than keeping up with inflation. So it's not a huge cut. And of course, the Pentagon wants to spend over $6 trillion in the next 10 years. So $450 billion sounds like a lot, but when you have that huge set of plans, it's not quite as intimidating. Even the $1 trillion that might hit if the super committee fails and there's automatic triggers that affect the Pentagon would put spending back to about 2007 levels, which by historical standards are quite high. So, you know, I think the real problem is the Pentagon and the contractors are used to having money flow freely. They want to keep it that way. And also, of course, they've mismanaged a lot of the money that they've received. And so in that respect, from their point of view, the more the better.
So we don't know whether the taxpayer is getting value for money with this new contracting raid on the Treasury, if you will. But what I think we do know is that it's permanent, right? That Cheney and company have placed this in the procurement system now, and it's locked in. In other words, the privatization juggernaut has moved on and can't be undone. Is that right?
Well, I think certainly not in its entirety, because they've sort of set things up so they're dependent on, these companies to do the laundry, to help them build bases overseas, to maintain equipment, and do guard duty in various places. So there have been recommendations from different places, including a colleague of mine when I was at the New America Foundation, who did a study on this, who said, "Well, don't let them have positions where they're carrying guns in a war zone." I think that would be a very positive reform, but I think that in itself would be quite difficult as well, because they're hiring former Green Berets, former Navy SEALs. They sort of view it as, they're getting these trained people as opposed to, sort of a new recruit. And, of course, it's at a huge cost. But the military seems, as you said, kind of structured almost, to depend on these contractors to do business.
So, William Hartung, if this super committee deadlocks and fails to find the $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions, then the automatic trigger comes in where the Pentagon would face a $500 billion in additional reductions over the next decade. Now, that may not be really the end of the world, even though there are all these dire predictions out there, given how much more we spend above what we were spending in the last decade. It's doubled, and we're spending more than the rest of the world combined. So you have this interesting alliance now where you've got the kind of Ron Paul people on the Tea Party side and a bunch of liberals on the Democratic side basically saying, that the sky's not falling and these cuts aren't enough. Do you think there's a chance that they could form a winning coalition?
I think there's definitely a chance. There's a lot of the Tea Party types who just, they don't want any kind of spending to happen without some sort of offset, some sort of cut elsewhere. And also they don't support tax increases. So, you know, there'll come a point where, you know, some of them, you know, they've said, well, if you have to choose between a tax increase and reducing military spending, they said, well, I would reduce military spending. So there is that possibility. And, you know, if anything, I think the liberal side needs to be shored up a bit. I mean, there's people like Barney Frank and people from the Progressive Caucus like Barbara Lee. But there's, you know, in leadership positions in the Democratic Party, there hasn't been a lot of talk about cutting beyond what Obama has suggested. So people like Carl Levin from Michigan and the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services and, the top leadership of the Democratic Party in both houses have been relatively silent about the notion of further reduction. So I think that would be, you know, if some of those people came over onto the side of sort of, you know, sensible reduction, then I think the dynamic would change dramatically.
And William Hartung, again, Project Director of the Center for International Policy and author of most recently of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. There's nothing more, I think, obscene and self-serving than Buck McKeon, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, breaking down in tears when he talks about our young men and women in uniform and the great sacrifices that they go through. Glenn Beck does the same thing on his TV and radio show. He brings him to tears, this patriotic fervor about what great soldiers and we have. But basically, we basically take care of the toys and not the boys, and that's the reality, in spite of all of that patriotic rhetoric. And now you've got McKeon and the rest of the Republicans who are dead against any Keynesianism in terms of stimulating the economy and bringing jobs back. And at the same time, military Keynesianism is okay. So, I mean, Krugman pointed this out recently in a column, what a hypocrite McKeon is, you know, that the Republicans won't do anything to get Americans back to work. But heavens forbid you should cut the defense budget, and then they cry jobs, jobs, jobs.
Well, it's fascinating because, it ends up, in addition to the hypocrisy factor, that military spending is about the worst way to create jobs. High salaries. There's not a lot of people doing actual production. It's almost sort of like a boutique operation in many cases. You hire teachers, you do energy efficiency, you work in infrastructure. Any of those would provide, 1.5 or more times as many jobs. Even a tax cut would do better than military spending. So, you know, if they really wanted to fight on that turf, the facts don't really support them. But, you know, in an ideal world, you would figure out what you need to defend the country, and that's what you would spend. You know, you wouldn't make these arguments about jobs. But, of course, that argument has really been kind of drowned out by fear-mongering. You know, so you have Panetta saying, you know, it's a doomsday scenario if the super committee cuts kick in, and you've got the chiefs of the services talking about how, you know, we could barely get across the ocean if, you know, the Navy would be hamstrung if we had these cuts. But they're, you know, far less than during any other build down in the history of the country. You know, much deeper cuts at the end of the Cold War, after Vietnam, after Korea. And I think this is one of those same kind of turning points where there's got to be a decision about what role the U.S. military is supposed to play in the world. And that's been, that debate has been sorely absent in the Congress and in a lot of the press coverage of this.
So what do you think is the who's got the upper hand? I mean, all of these, the sky is falling stuff seems to be capturing the headlines, in the press. I guess in a way, the Tea Party people are pretty good at capturing headlines. So in this battle, we know that the military-industrial complex has the more lobbyists than anybody else, so tell me about whether you think that's going to how that's going to pan out.
Well, I think, you know, if it was just based on traditional measures of political power, number of lobbyists, campaign spending, the fact that they can play the jobs card, you know, you would assume that the military-industrial complex is going to win this battle. But I think because of the nature of the deficit fight, the fact that revenues seem to be off the table, the fact that I think there'll be, hopefully, there will be some sort of deadlock over cutting entitlements, and there, you know, those won't be shaved back dramatically. So then it comes down to a very small part of the budget. And if the Pentagon doesn't take a cut, then everything else in the budget other than Medicare and Social Security would be so drastically cut that, I think you would see pushback from people all over the country. So I think because of that, you know, unless the only option where I see the pressure being reduced on the arms lobby is if Congress just says we're not going to reduce the deficit at all, and the politics of the moment don't seem to favor that. So I think they're working against some kind of economic and historic trends, which makes it a bigger climb for them to necessarily get what they want this time around. And you know, historically, the arms lobby has had to take its hits. Not, you know, usually it's you know, decades apart, but I think this might be one of those times where they're you know, even all the power that they have is not going to be enough to get them everything that they want.
So if we, just in closing then, if we save a lot of money from getting out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan in 2014, is there going to be any peace dividend? We've had these drawdowns in the past that have been much, much more radical than anything we're talking about now. So it seems like the defense hawks in the military-industrial complex have somehow gotten away with raising the bar and keeping this high, outrageously high $700 billion figure, which, you know, outspends the entire world combined. That's become the new normal.
Well, unfortunately, it has. And, you know, a lot of the screaming about cuts really has to do with, you know, slowing the rate of growth of that, you know, unbelievable figure. And then there's going to be a fight that's already kind of beginning over the reductions in war spending, because the, you know, contrary to people like the Stimson Center, who pointed out that the military has actually modernized itself in the middle of these two wars, the advocates of high spending are saying, oh, we have to take the money that was going to the wars and use it to you know, reset the military and refurbish our equipment and buy new things that we sort of deferred during the wars. So that even the savings on the war spending is going to be subject to, you know, serious political fight.
Well, I thank you for joining us, William Hartung, here today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who is project director at the Center for International Policy. Previously, he was a research fellow at the New America Foundation's strategy program and a director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.